TV. Inspiring people across the planet to be a little kinder and a little more gentle with each other. Delivering inspirational TV, one story at a time, from my lounge to yours. I'm your host, Tony Lontis.
Good day, everyone. It is almost lunchtime in Australia. It's lunchtime for Lisa in Sydney, and good evening to everyone listening across America. You're listening to Tony Lontis on Radio Tony, Everyday Business, and we are joined today by the gorgeous Lisa Coletta from The Governance Collective. And this is our second show together in a series of eight. And today we're going to be talking about organizational structure in business and corporations and why it should be such an important consideration in what you do. But before we get on today's show, just a reminder that we are live streaming into Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Twitch. And you can also see and listen to Radio Tony Everyday Business on bbsradiotv.com. And today, just a reiteration about the glorious Lisa. Lisa is a passionate corporate governance change leader, and she leads a collective of senior specialists that shape, drive, and implement right-sized, efficient governance policy and related frameworks and processes into businesses and corporations. She's worked in both the private and public sector in a career that spans over two decades in governance at all different levels. She's defined and rejuvenated governance frameworks and processes, enabling effective decision making in many organizations. And she's done this via advising chairs, boards, committees, managing directors, and executives at a corporate governance level. By doing this, she's enabled them to be reactive and adaptive in their management processes and aids their business strategy. She holds a master's degree in management, a postgrad in applied corporate governance, and she's a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. She's also qualified as a neuro-linguistic programming coach and practitioner, and she is a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. So, good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm really good. Now, I'm going to ask you a quick question before we get on to our important subject for today. Today, we want to talk about governance and why that's important in business. But before I do, we were texting before the show and you were working on a particular document. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, I had a feeling you were going to ask me this question. Yes. I was pre-show tapping away, writing a confidentiality deed. And it's basically an undertaking, a confidentiality document that I produce. And it's an agreement between myself and my clients around how I handle and manage their information, not only during the consultancy or during when I provide them services, but also afterwards as well. And the reason why I always offer a confidentiality agreement or deed or undertaking to be signed is to give my clients comfort that whatever they do reveal to us is actually going to be kept safe and it's going to be kept confidential. Because in most cases, when we go into organisations, they're actually revealing their vulnerabilities to us, their organisational vulnerabilities. And we help put great governance frameworks in place and different kinds of mechanisms to help protect and defend them. But at the same time, they need to know that we're stepping in and we're doing it in a safe way, and we're not going to, you know, leave and provide the information around vulnerabilities to their competitors or anyone else. So that is what I was doing.
Which leads us perfectly into our subject for today, which is talking around governance, organizational structure, and why it's so important. So for those of you that are listening, I'm sure you've all heard the frame organizational structure, but how many of our listeners have actually put some thought to what that looks like? So Lisa, let's start with a conversation about what is organizational structure.
Sure. So Tony, when people hear the word structure, their minds go to a lot of different places and spaces. typically they actually go to the organizational hierarchy or the organizational structure in the organization. And, you know, as we all know, that structure is there to actually define the reporting relationships between roles in organizations. I have from time to time come across organizations that have no organizational structure. And what tends to happen is that there's no clear picture of the workflow and the decision making that actually needs to occur in that organization. And it's more about relying on people as opposed to relying on structure and process. The other thing that does come to mind for some people around organizational structure is that there's the official one that's on the piece of paper that's in the annual report. And then there's the political structure, which is actually how things really happen and how the decision making really occurs. And it may or may not actually align with that structure, depending on the informal, undocumented relationships between individuals within the organizations. Of course, you know you've got a great structure when your organization is actually able to add positions to enable the growth of the organization quite cleanly and quite easily. And everyone working within that structure or within the roles of that structure have a really great picture of where they sit and how they sit in relation to the reporting hierarchy and the workflow of how and where the authorities and the decision making actually goes and actually plays out. So that's organizational structure at most basic level. It does rely on the right people doing the right things, of course, as always.
So Lisa, well, I want to delve a little bit more into that concept of organizational structure. And for me, you often think about big corporations having organizational structure. I actually want to talk about the importance of even solopreneurs and smaller organizations having that framework. Why is it important for even small organizations to think about their structure, i.e. who they engage with, who they report to? Why is it so important for small organizations as well as large ones?
So my view is that it's actually more important for small organizations to have it than large ones. And the reason for that is because small organizations do tend to rely more on people than on process, because they don't have as many bodies around to pick up the slack if someone's away or whatever else. You speak to a lot of small business owners, and I find especially that a lot of them don't go on holidays. And the reason why they don't go on holidays is because they just don't have the backup systems and processes for the work that they do to actually be supported when they're away. Or they'll go on holidays and then they'll spend 3 or 4 weeks afterwards cleaning up all the mess around the decision-making or lack of decision-making while they've been away. So organizational structure is really, really important. Small businesses also tend to not put in really important governing documents or governing framework. Uh-huh. And one of them especially is a document called the Delegations of Authority. And so the way the delegations work is that when you have an organizational structure, each role in the organization has a certain level of authorities to enable them, the people within those roles, to undertake that work efficiently and effectively. And when an organization doesn't have a document like that, there isn't really a go-to process or a go-to sort of control point where everyone can be really clear around which roles can make which decisions at which time. And it's one of those things where in some small organizations, individuals either think they've got all the power in the world or they've got none at all. And even the business owners are sometimes surprised that their team members are making decisions that they, in their view, don't actually have the authority to make. But again, it comes back to having this controlled, centralized document so that everyone has complete clarity and an understanding on what they can do and what they can't do. So small businesses do really need them.
So Lisa, let's look at that in terms of, so if you're a solopreneur, there's no way if you have a thriving business that you can do that on your own. So we're talking about what happens when the business manager is away, who makes the decisions? What happens when the CEO is away, who makes those decisions? And if you clearly document and articulate that in a document, then perhaps your accountant has permission to do certain financial things within the business if you're not there, or your business manager may have permission to make certain decisions around XYZ, or the head of the person who runs your marketing may have delegation to post on social media in your behalf. Just thinking of a kind of modern entrepreneurial space. What are the components that you consider most important in an organizational structure?
So I guess the most important component is actually having defined roles. And those defined roles, or those defined positions, need to have clearly articulated accountabilities and an understanding of what that role entails and how much authority they have within that role and that environment. So great looking models have a role description of 2 or 3 pages that outlines what the actual role is and where it actually sits within that hierarchy or within that environment. The second component they would have is, as I mentioned, a delegations of authority document. And I know it sounds very official, but it really is a table that shows all the positions within the organisation and what authorities they have in different types of categories of decision making. So, for example, if certain roles need to spend money to undertake their work, they've got a cap on how much money they can spend. They also may be, you know, entering into contracts on behalf of the organization. They may be undertaking certain things. And the great things about a delegations of authority document is that when an individual actually sits in a role, they take that authority on based on that role. If they're actually going to be acting in another role, or they're doing 2 roles while someone is away, they actually have the authorities of both of those roles at the same time. And some organisations, as you mentioned, may choose to put in a special, I guess, protocol in place whenever the managing director or the CEO or the business manager is actually not around. They can set up a nice delegations process so that for a certain amount of time, based on certain protocols, certain accountant or whoever else. So those things can also occur if that is actually required. Unfortunately, a lot of business owners, I think, learn the hard way where unforeseen circumstances occur, where a business owner who's, you know, been in the business for a long time suddenly becomes ill or has to look, you know, take care of their significant other because they're unwell, and they're just suddenly offline and none of this stuff is in place. Businesses do really suffer, especially small businesses, quite a lot when this occurs, because individuals within the organisation that are seeking power are going to take that power because no one's taking it. And individuals who don't want to take accountability for anything are, of course, not stepping up and not only not doing their own role, but they're also not actually stepping up and filling that gap or that hole either. So there's quite a few risks associated with not having these kinds of protocols and documents in place.
Yeah. So Lisa, this is part of what the governance collective does as a wider part of your role within business and corporations. And so you can actually step in and nut out what the particular business structure is, what roles and role descriptions are important in that business, and you can set that whole thing up for small business relatively easily, can't you?
Look, I definitely can. And it's actually, it's not really a huge piece of work, because in a lot of circumstances, organisations already have informal delegations in place, but it's more about what individuals know they can and can't do as opposed to what's actually documented and formalised. So, yeah, we do go into organisations and do that. One important thing I think to note for your listeners out there, or our listeners out there today, Tony, is that the delegation of authority are actually driven from the board or from the owners of a business. So if you're a small business owner who has a board, the board is actually officially and formally sub-delegating their authority onto key roles within the organisation. So there is a hierarchy and an approvals process that gets undertaken as part of that as well. And, yeah, we actually come in and work with business owners and boards and executive to help them define those lines of where those authorities are nice and cleanly. And, of course, the roles that they actually play as well. I have a really nice diagram, Tony, I'd love to share with your listeners and your viewers.
Yes, please.
Let me just jump in and see whether technology is going to behave itself for us today.
Yeah. Now.
Here we go. So bear with me while I share my screen. I'm hoping that everyone can see this. One of the important parts around delegations of authority. There it is. Did it turn up? Yay. One of the important components of delegations of authority and actually defining roles is being really, really clear about where roles typically play. And we talked in our last session, Tony, about what governance is. And I defined it as organizations actually defining, approving, and holding lines of authority in the organization. So to, I guess, continue with that theme, organizational structures are the formalized aspects of the organization defining those decision-making and those approval lines. And so the diagram that's in front of you shows where roles typically play in an organization. And now it is a typical, it's not every organization, and it's you know, some organizations may actually have lines in slightly different spots depending on the organization and how and where they're situated from a growth standpoint and a size standpoint. But typically boards are at least 90% strategy and around 10% operations, maybe a little bit less than that. And CEOs, managing directors or chief operating officers tend to actually have a significant amount of strategy with some operations, because they're the ones that are actually providing input into the strategy, but they're there to define and plan for the delivery of the strategy. They're where the rubber hits the road. And then, of course, the senior executive team have a much, much broader amount of operational oversight and accountability, with some components of strategy within it as well. They need to understand the strategy to be able to apply it within the organization. And then, of course, there's the senior management teams and people on the ground who are predominantly operational, but depending on the nature of their role, they need to understand how their role fits into the bigger, broader picture of business plan and the strategic components of the business as well. So defining these lines in a nice, clean way where everyone understands enables businesses of any size and any shape, to have really, really clear points of accountability within the organization that they're operating in. What it also does, Tony, it enables the business to be really clear around how performance is actually occurring within the business. Not only how the business is performing, but how individuals are performing as well. One of the toughest things I find when I speak to business owners, and in fact any leaders, is around people management and having real conversations around performance. The more performance can be defined and expectations can be defined up front around what looks good and what isn't hitting the mark before the, you know, the actual activity or the project starts is actually defined, the much clearer and cleaner it is to have those conversations, and you don't have that blurry line where avoidant behavior tends to sort of sneak in and take over. Because the foundations of where the lines are and where the expectations are and where the powers and decision-making is isn't actually defined right up front. So we help organisations come in and we come in and help them actually define these lines nice and cleanly. And we know when we've got it right, when it just sits nicely. It's not overkill. It's not, you know, very, very heavy governance that means that everyone has to do 100 more things to get their jobs done every day or in every way.
Yes.
It's really more of an underlying way they do their work. So we know when we've got it right, when we hit that sweet spot around that. So I'll include this diagram for those that are listening and not watching the live stream. I'll include a copy of this diagram into our blog this week so people can have a look at it. And I will stop sharing.
And it will also be available on the Radio Tony website as well as a downloadable for people who want to have a look at that. In its simplest form, Lisa, organizational structure can be defined as a person joined to another person in a hierarchical structure. So for those of us that have worked within corporate And in government, these diagrams are part of what you are introduced to as soon as you start working in these bigger environments. But for many others who haven't had personal experience in those upper echelons of either corporate or government organizations, this may be unfamiliar, but essentially it's just a diagram with the CEO or whoever it is up top aligned to usually their finance, usually sidelined to their VA, PA, executive assistant, and so on and so forth. And it is really clear who talks to who, how they communicate, and then in the background of that simple line document will be the roles and responsibilities. And of course, that's really an important consideration for each business to start thinking. And I know since I started talking to Lisa that all my corporate experience is coming back to me in a flood, and I've got notes everywhere about I want to set up my own organizational structure. Now, I'm a solopreneur or an entrepreneur. I am the CEO of my own business, but I've been reminded by Lisa how important these elements of business and structure are to have in place. And so I've been doing my own little work around my own organizational structure to have that in place because I see it as important. So some of the key processes that every business should have in place when we're talking about corporate and business governance, what are those, Lisa?
So I guess at the very core is risk management. Every organisation should, regardless of its size, consider risk. A lot of us, you know, sole businesses or, you know, entrepreneurs tend to manage risk in a quite an informal way. It doesn't mean that risk isn't being managed. They're considering it in a much more informal sort of, I guess, context. But as your organisation, as your business grows, the formalisation of risk management is really incredibly important. I'd say that it'd probably be the most important or the core. And part of the reason for that is, of course, because the better the organisation is at proactively managing risk, the more effective the decision-making is in that organisation at all levels. Obviously, boards, it's very hard for a board in an organisation, for those larger businesses, to make decisions when they're not on the ground and they're not really understanding, because they're not there on a daily basis, or they shouldn't be there on a daily basis, understanding what is actually occurring within the business environment. And the risk management framework assists boards in getting a really good picture of what they need to worry about and what they don't when they undertake decision making. The other component of the risk framework too, Tony, I'm not sure if you've heard of this before or not, but there's this thing called a risk appetite. Have you ever heard of a risk appetite before?
I have, yes. Yeah, yes, so but let's tell our listeners, I actually quite enjoy talking about risk because in a previous life I actually invented a risk matrix around health services and it still remains one of my delights in life. So, yeah, let's talk risk.
All right, so let's talk risk. So a risk appetite statement is a really beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing in an organisation because each of us as individuals step into these organisational environments with a different personal risk appetite depending on who we are and how we're conditioned, you know, during our childhood, during us growing up. What that means is that some of us taking risks is not really a big deal because you might have been brought up in an environment. You're used to making decisions really easily and quickly. In fact, it might be easier for you to make that decision because you're not actually playing with your own money. You're playing with someone else's money and someone else's business. Yeah. However, boards, great risk management frameworks and great organizations that do a great job of managing risk define their risk appetite, which is basically what level of risk they're actually willing to wear before they need to start investing in additional controls or additional treatments to manage risks that have been identified in an organization. I do find in some organizations, Tony, that when it comes to managing risk, as soon as a risk is identified, there's an assumption that it has to be immediately managed. And one of the things I can say to those small business owners if you provide or if you define your risk management framework and your risk processes and your appetite at the right level, you may find that there are some risks that can actually sit there and be maintained at a certain level without you constantly
yes.
investing and spending more money on being worried about it.
Yes.
It tends to be those things that keep the CEO or the managing director or the business owner awake at night. That tends to be yes. the stuff they feel that they need to control and manage a lot better. In a lot of circumstances, the risks that are identified in organisations tend to be these symptoms around how well or otherwise their corporate governance framework is actually working or operating.
Yes.
So in a lot of cases, the answer to managing a risk is to put a new procedure, tighten an existing procedure or process up, or put a new procedure or process in place because we're doing an additional thing now and we haven't actually considered how to formally manage the side effects or the outcomes of delivering that particular product or service. So managing risk yeah. is a really important part of that. One of the other frameworks that I think is really important is an ethics and values framework. And values. And the reason why ethics and values are so incredibly important really does come back to that whole conversation around individuals working towards the goals of the organization and everyone being on the same page. So if you've got a great risk management framework where everyone's really clear around what we're managing and what we are worrying about and what we're not, you've got a great structure in place and you've got fantastic delegations of authority in place so people know where to play. Their governance structure is defined, so there's really clear lines of accountabilities and from a decision-making standpoint. The overlay over the top of all of that is values and behaviours. And the reason for that is because we find that as individuals, as humans, we all trust in different ways. So when you think of that yep. word trust, and for those who are, you know, working in organizations of any type or size, we've all been in an environment or in a situation where we just sense that the leader above us just doesn't trust us. And the reason why we sense that is because they're either telling us we don't trust you, or by their actions where they're constantly, you know, checking up on you, constantly concerned that you haven't done the job that they expected you to do and all that kind of thing. Trust is a really, really interesting thing. And I've actually got another little diagram I'd love to share with you, Tony, and your listeners.
Yes, please.
Trust is different things for each individual. Trust is one of those things where individuals are actually triggered. Oops, wrong slide. There it is. Did it turn up? I'm hoping that you've got a big diagram yes. with the word in the middle there. Great.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful piece, I know, a beautiful work of art there. Trust is one of those things, Tony, that is different for everyone. So what might actually trigger me around not feeling trust between another individual may be different to actually what triggers you. So I'll ask you, Tony, when you look at the words in this diagram, I've got the, for those who are listening and can't see it right now, I will include it in the blog after the show, but I've got a diagram with all of these describing words or I guess factors around what makes anyone feel trust or otherwise. So look at all the lists there, Tony, and tell me which out of all of these words, what's the one thing that you know triggers you to go, oh, I don't quite trust, I don't feel quite right about this, I'm not feeling quite trusting?
I think it's probably authentic.
Authenticity.
And, yeah, I think it's authenticity followed by integrity and then calm, resoluteness. They would be my three.
Yeah, so authenticity, when an individual's not very confident in demonstrating their skills and experience, Tony, you kind of go, oh, something within you, your intuition or something really deep within you is actually going, I don't think I'm getting the real person here, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then you said integrity. So integrity is about
yes.
individuals being responsible for their actions and doing what they say. And it's actually linked to their moral and ethical principles. And it's one of those things where, you know, for some, if you don't have integrity, you know, you have nothing if you don't have, you know, hold your integrity or have your integrity and that responsibility yeah. around. The third one you mentioned was calm resoluteness, and that is around responding and not reacting in stressful times. So this
yeah.
this concept of reaction first responding is an interesting one, especially when you consider trust and you consider managing risk, and then you put an overlay of the top of it around whether a board trusts their executive. So I actually show this slide. I show this slide to a lot of boards, and I ask the board members to go around the room and say, tell me what is it that triggers you around distrusting your CEO or distrusting whoever it is that they're actually, you know, they have some issues with. And they will say to me, oh, I just don't find them reliable. They're not consistent. They say what they do and they don't say what they do and they don't do what they say. And so for some individuals, by certain components, and this is actually a really tricky job for business owners who have boards or CEOs that have boards above them, because the trust between the board and management is really, really important. And this is where values and behaviors actually come in. When a board and executive come together and co-create and define their values and their behaviors for their organization, they're drawing another defined line around what's acceptable behavior and what's not. However, values and behaviors are most effective when they are principles based and not rules.
Okay.
So one of the things that we find, again, when we come into organizations or go into organizations, is that some organizations want their policies, including their code of conduct, to be written like a rule. Very, very clean cans and can'ts. You can do this, you can't do that. What it means when you have a rule book or compliance-based environment from a value standpoint, there's a little bit of wiggle room for individuals to say, well, it's not in the rules, that must mean I can't do it. Or if it's not in the rules, that means I can do it. And what you're doing is you're taking away the opportunity for individuals to use their own personal judgment. So, Tony... So like yourself, Tony, I hire within the governance collective, I hire people to work within my collective, and I hire them for their knowledge, skills and experience, but I'm also hiring them for judgment. So any policies that I put in place, I have an expectation, A, that they're applying the values and behaviours that I've set for my business, because that's part of their employment. The terms and conditions of their employment is that they'll actually apply the values and behaviours. But the policies I write are principles-based policy. And the reason why I write principles-based policy is because principles-based policy provides the core principles and guidance around the delivery of whatever it is that the policy is strategically directing them to do. But it's relying on them to use their knowledge, their skills, and their experience and their personal judgment to apply them. So behaviors that are not rules-based, they're principles-based, means that the individuals need to use their knowledge, their skills, and their experience to apply the principles, the values of the organization. What it also means, Tony, is that when they get it wrong, they're accountable for that.
Right. Yes. Okay. So you're attaching accountability to what they do. So this is pretty important stuff even for a small business, because your business has a brand and a reputation, and if that's important component of what you do, you want to make sure that you have these things in place, because that protects you and your brand at the end of the day, doesn't it?
It definitely does. And when you look at this diagram around trust, I gave the example of the trust between the board and the executive, between the strategic the organization, the operational. Think about it in the context between your organization and your customers. Now your customers are also going to be triggered by the same types of things that are associated with trust as your management team would. So for example, if you're an organization that isn't acting as they think or isn't operating with integrity, the individuals in your business aren't operating with integrity, and your customers are wearing the consequences of that, when trust is broken, they're no longer your customer anymore.
Customers
walk away every day because they don't feel they can, they don't want to give you their money because trust. They don't trust you. And so Think about some of those sort of higher level brands out there, and I don't think we'll get into specifics, but you think about those brands that may have more recently have been in the news because you expected the you expected them to be reliable and they weren't. You expected them
I'm
to
in be, particular yeah. thinking of a certain women's athletic brand.
Yes.
That has been in the news a number of times around employee behavior, corporate behavior. And I know that I've made a value judgment based on those news stories about that particular brand that I actually wouldn't purchase from them because
yes.
of the
yes.
issues around the way they've treated their employees or the way that they've come out in public with public statements, that doesn't align with me. So therefore, I don't want to align myself with that particular brand. I'm quite sure that you've heard of lots of instances of that as well, Lisa.
Oh, look, absolutely. You see it all the time. You see it from a customer and from a branding standpoint. You see it
yes.
from definitely reputational risk is very, very strong, really, really strong impact. The optics around distrust are very, very hard to manage. I am, you know, you see it everywhere. I really find it a little bit probably too interesting to view it in political environments. And so
yes.
I live in a state called New South Wales, and I look at our political, you know, the political happenings.
Yes.
Like anywhere else in the
current
world.
This week.
Quite currently this week. We've got some stuff going on, not just around COVID-19, but around, you know, behaviours of premiers. Even look
yes.
at it from the perspective of the decision-making around going to vote. You know
yes.
that you want whoever's in charge to be, you want them to be trusted. You want to be able to trust them. They need to be fair. They need to be loyal. They need to be reliable. They need to have integrity.
Yep.
They need to act as they think. They need to be truthful. And you think
yes.
of all those components that are actually really, really important to the political decision-making in the organisation that you're in and
yes.
the political decision-making in the country that you're in. It's actually that
mm-hmm.
same judgment call and the same skill set and that same part really deep within us where you sit back and go, I don't know, something doesn't sit quite right. And with that
yes.
individual, with that decision, with that particular dynamic, can I trust them?
It's about the I'm thinking of some world politics that are really current at the moment, and I'm thinking of the particular incumbent person and the support or not support for this particular person. And I feel like shouting from the rooftops, yes, he's saying this, but are you hearing the actions that sit behind those words? I do not trust this person.
I do not trust
yeah.
you. Deep within you whether you trust someone or not. So in every organization, that same dynamic plays out. It plays on the political world stage. It plays in, you know, local
yes.
government. It plays in every organization. It even plays in every household.
Yes.
Applicability
yes.
around trust is really, really important. I have a teenage son, and with certain
mm-hmm.
things, I trust him. Without a doubt, I absolutely trust him. With certain things, I know that he's still a man-child. And there are certain
yes.
parts of his decision-making and his judgment isn't quite where I feel it needs to be. And I've done, you know, as we all do as parents, we do our best to provide them really, really great decision-making, you know, skills for them to be able to
yes.
use their judgment and make their own decisions. And, of course, there's going to be accountability associated with the decisions they make as well.
Yeah.
When it comes to an organisation, drawing these lines is hard unless you have a really great picture of what an ideal culture looks like, and
yes.
you draw lines around what values are in place and what behaviours you expect from your people. Defining
yeah, definitely.
The behaviours of your organisation is really important. It's kind of an underlying part of making sure that
yep.
your governance works effectively, because
yeah.
You know, something as simple as truthfulness. No, you know, there's lots of mechanisms we can put in place in a governance framework environment to enable transparency.
Yes.
There's no other real way of testing truthfulness. Is your employee
no.
telling you the truth right now? Unless you have the
yeah.
right governing framework and performance metrics and really, really
yes.
show me, not tell me accountabilities. It's hard to actually pinpoint certain components of demonstrable components of trust. And that's where the rubber hits the road when it comes to putting in great governing frameworks. So we've talked about risk, we've talked about ethics and values, we've talked about delegations of authority. The other component that I guess we've sort of touched on sort of more broadly is around performance management and having really great performance mechanisms in place in organizations to enable them to be able to clearly and transparently understand how the organization's performing and how the individuals are performing. So I would recommend that organizations consider what they have in that place as well.
Which we're going to talk in great detail about next week, team management, components of HR and why they're important. Before, I just had a quick thought about risk management in terms of small business. And risk management actually is, you can simplify it down to what insurances do you have in terms of what if your bricks and mortar business burnt down? Do you have insurance? So you can actually, risk comes back to some very simple things that you can have within your business that protect you from some predictable or, well, not predictable, but what if such and such happens? What would we do in that situation? That's risk management 101. Mm-hmm. What if this happened? What would we do? How can I prevent that happening? What protections for the does the business have if this happens? So what protections does a small business have if the employee that you've employed goes out and defames the business holus bolus? That's risk management. And if you're a small business and you're not considering risk management, you need to. So it's not just the big corporations, the big organizations. It's really important to small business as well, because often you don't have that capacity or the capital to ride out something that could destroy your reputation or the services you provide. So that, in talking about corporate governance, risk management is one of those key things that we need to have in place, don't we, Lisa?
Yep, we most definitely do. And we've all been tested just recently, Tony, over the last, what is it now? I can't even remember, since March here in Sydney. We've all been tested.
That's a great question, is it? How many businesses have a COVID strategy as part of managing risk? How many businesses have actually thought about that or thought about it and done what you've needed to do? But you should consider documenting what you've done to help you get through COVID 2020.
Absolutely. And a few businesses that I've spoken to have said that they haven't had a pandemic risk identified. None of the scenario plans that they've done even considered managing pandemics. However, they did do things like, well, what happens if our building, you know, ends up getting, you know, knocked down or there's a bomb threat or whatever, whatever. Yes. They do have their disaster recovery or their business continuity management plans in place so that they can enable employees to be able to work offline. So for a lot of organizations, they have had that. For some, they haven't, but they have relied on the fact that all of us are quite well connected in our home environments with Wi-Fi and all the rest of it. So there is quite a bit of, sort of flexibility around that. But you're absolutely right, Tony. There's a lot of learnings around how we've adapted and adopted our work operation as part of managing the COVID environment. So I think that that's a really good point. People should be documenting and being really clear about what that looks and feels like. I also do think that moving forward, we are, and I know we probably hear this language a lot, there's actually a new normal and a different way of working now. I don't know that anyone really thinks that things are going to go back to the same way before. And so some organisations may want to consider how that working from home arrangement is actually formalised in their policies and how that looks and feels in regards to OH&S implications from a risk standpoint, as well as what it also means when individuals are undertaking the work that needs to be delivered, as well as managing caregiving to their family or their their children or their family. So there are a couple of different, I guess, variables around that they may want to consider as well. And we can certainly help them with that too if they'd like to reach out.
Definitely. Do you think that the businesses that you've been connected with have had to actually look at their organisational structure, their policies and procedures directly related to what's happened this year?
I think quite a few of them have. I think in a lot of cases they have, because two things have occurred. Either production of their goods or services has dropped, and what that looks and feels like and what that means for, not only their bottom line, but how they're actually undertaking their operations to streamline and make their operations a lot more efficient and a lot more effective. For some organisations, they've gone through the roof. They've increased dramatically. I know of a vitamin company that has had a huge influx in certain products that they can't get them on the shelves fast enough. And so their warehousing program and the oversight around delivery and the discussion with manufacturers and all the rest of it have really forced them to go back and have a look at them thinking a little bit more smarter about getting their product out faster. So and it's around that agility. One of the great things about managing risk for organizations, even though it might sound like a little bit of a drag, especially for small business, is that you actually know what you need to worry about and you know what you don't need to worry about. And it enables you to have this agility to be able to move a little bit faster when it comes to decision making. And I think for a lot of businesses, they've either, realized how agile they are, or they realize that they're not very agile at all as part of this pandemic, unfortunately.
I remember having, I guess you'd call them forums or workshops, complete days around risk for bigger organisations. It doesn't have to take that long if you're in a small business, but just sitting and thinking about the risks of to you and your business and working out a plan to either negate, because some risks you can completely negate, some you can actively manage, and some you will just leave sitting there to work on as you grow and change. But it's really a valuable thing to do, is to know ahead of time some of the things that could or couldn't go wrong in your business and have some planning around, okay, what happens if, that's not suggesting that those things will actually eventuate, but isn't it better to have those things planned and have a strategy around them than be confronted and go, oh my God, what do we do now, versus having a plan? It should give businesses, particularly small business, some peace of mind around those things that keep them up at night.
Absolutely. And it comes back to that calm resoluteness that we were talking about in my diagram earlier, the difference between responding and reacting. Just because you're managing risks doesn't mean the risks won't come up. They will come up. They could potentially come up. But it's the difference between responding to that risk and being ready for it versus reacting to that. Because what we can sometimes do is we can overreact. We can either assume the risk is quite small and then we hit it with a sledgehammer, or alternatively, we might think that the risk is actually, much larger than it is, and it is actually larger than what it really is. And what we are doing is actually not making a dent into the real problem, because we don't understand the real risk. We don't understand the real problem, and we're trying to understand it and deal with it at the same time. So managing risks enables organizations to be really proactive and really responsive to enable them to effectively make decisions. So,
That's also, Lisa, where the governance collective comes in, because of all your experience around managing risks. I'm suggesting that from your experience standpoint, you can go into an organisation or a business, no matter how big or small, and you'll know, okay, these risks are going to be evident. And then once you get together with that business and spend some time running through those, there will be others that crop up. And then it's a simple task of putting some management around that. And that's all that risk is. And it plays into that corporate governance and organizational structure, because then you know in this instance, the CEO is going to do this and the finance manager is going to do this and the executive assistant is going to do this. So everyone should have some idea and respond in a way that's appropriate to whatever risk the business is facing.
Absolutely. Yep, most definitely. And what I will be sharing with you next week is really lovely framework that actually assists organizations in doing exactly that. It's going to show that you can link your strategy and your business plan to your risk processes, and that the oversight of your business plan and the accountability actually drip filters through to all the right accountable officers in your business. So they're accountable for delivering it. And the treatment and the management of risk is actually part of everyone's daily job. And so, again, everyone's on the front foot. Everyone's really clear of where they play. Everyone knows where the lines are. And everyone's moving towards the organizational goals instead of spending too much time trying to manage or react to risks that they haven't seen coming. It's really more fundamental to the way the business
is. Because the thing is that if you take again, we'll be talking about this next week, the management of teams and performance management. If you have a disruptive or destructive employee, wouldn't it be better to have policies, procedures, frameworks, whatever it is, around the management of that before it happens? Because let's face it, most businesses and corporations are gonna be hit with the disruptive, destructive employee. It's one of those things in corporates and business. Wouldn't it be better to have a process and a way forward before you get hit with that, rather than try and look at it afterwards and try and manage it retrospectively rather than proactively?
Look, absolutely. We do get called from time to time into businesses where they do have that, and it is very evident that there were some fundamental foundational things that they didn't have in place that they really needed. There are expectations placed on employees to deliver outcomes, and how those expectations are actually documented is incredibly important, and whether they're agreed to or whether they're co-created is also equally important, because the more that individuals actually own the accountabilities, the more they're going to deliver on them. And it comes back to and the style of leaders that the individuals are as well. And so we find that the more heart-centered the leaders are from a governing standpoint, the more effective the frameworks are that they put in place to enable the right kind of conversations and the right kind of relationships right in front with these employees when it comes to these conversations around setting performance objectives, monitoring performance, and delivering on outcomes. And I'll share a little bit more with you as well in our next session around managing teams and performance management as well. To be a heart-centered governing leader when you're actually delivering that.
Absolutely. A really important conversation for us next week and for the show next week is around that heart-centered leadership and how that transforms teams of people and about that team management. So I'm really excited that we have gotten to the third show, which will be about that heart-centered leadership. It's topical at the moment, and I think that it will only continue to be more and more topical. I know that many of the bigger HR firms that are actively headhunting for CEOs and high-level executives are considering heart-centered leadership as an emotional intelligence as a key component of the people that they want in their corporations, in their business, and leading their people. So, Lisa, we are out of time again. That show's gone completely quickly. For those listeners who want to catch up, we will have the blog, number one. We will have the diagrams, number two, downloadable from radiotony.com. And if you want to connect with Lisa and her team at the Governance Collective, I'm going to let Lisa tell you the best way to connect with her right now.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tony. The best way to connect with us is to pop us an email on support@governancecollective.com. And if you'd like to reach out to me directly, I am on LinkedIn. Just search for Lisa Coletta at the Governance Collective. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much, Lisa. And that, my wonderful listeners and viewers, this week is Radio Tony Everyday Business finished. Next week, same time, join Lisa and I, and we're going to be having a fabulous conversation about heart-centered leadership and team management, along with lots of other nuggets of gold that will help your business and organization get their organizational structure and processes in place. That's it for this week. Thank you so much, Lisa. And over to you now, TJ.
Bye for now.